Hello, good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whatever. It's welcome to the next All About Symbian Inside podcast. After a quick look up in the RSS feed, I'm confident in declaring that this is Insight number 134. I'm Ewan Spence, and joining me today, as always, the man who bravely lets me hold the microphone, Rafe Blanford.
Hello, people.
The man who suggested it might be a good idea that I host today's show, Steve Litchfield.
And I'm regretting it already.
And the man who is desperately trying to catch up with all the cliches and in-jokes, but is doing admirable in any case, David Gilson.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, chaps. It's been a fun week. It's been a fun month. Obviously, things are sort of bubbling away. There are big events happening in September, but there's lots of news and chat to go through just now. Steve, let's start with you. I know you've been sitting with the 8, 9, 10, and the ongoing saga of the custom firmwares that are coming out from the communities. This is giving a lot of life to this Samsung phone, isn't it?
It is. Just a brief apology to people. If you hear a sucking noise in the background, I know people have been saying I suck for a long time, but I'm literally, because I've got a horrible sore throat, but I will do my best. Samsung's i910 custom firmware. There's two varieties, actually. There's HX V832, which is basically the latest from a Samsung model extraordinaire HyperX, a.k.a. Andy somebody or other, over in Germany. And there's also, for the first time, if you look at the All About Symbian story, I've linked to his big rival in custom firmwares, the i910, whose name is Finil. Well, that's his nickname. A firmware N204, nicknamed the Queen, rather curiously. I've been sticking to the HX firmwares. I know them rather better, and they're less wacky. I think, Ewan, if you had an i910, you'd head straight for the N204, because they're, everything's different. There's the thumb wheel interfaces and Wizzy this and Wizzy that, but the HyperX ones tend to play things rather more with a straight bat. There's my English cricketing metaphor. The main things in this latest release are the fact that, you know, on a Symbian touch phone, and all three of you will have tried this, you tap on the applications icon, and there's usually a wait of 2, 3, 4 seconds before anything appears. And this is kind of normal on Symbian. When you've installed, I don't know, 20, 30 applications, you kind of think, okay, well, it's got to build the application list. Wrong. The Andy, the HyperX, has actually spotted this is actually a bug in Symbian OS's interface, or an S65th edition interface. And by a simple tweak, he's managed to make that go away. So now on the latest HX firmware, you tap on the application icon and the icons have come up instantly, even if you've got 50 or 60 applications installed, which is really, really impressive. Also notable in this latest firmware is the fact there's a new keyboard. So the on-screen keyboard that's been an S65th edition since the start has now been replaced by a 5-row or 4-row keyboard with a complete dedicated number row and all the extra punctuation. And it fits really well on the 3.7-inch display. So just for those two reasons alone, I would say recommend any i910 owners to upgrade. There is a fairly easy upgrade path. You do lose everything in the flash, but yeah, because you're going from one version of HX8 to another, you can just back up everything to a standard memory card backup. Everything apart from settings and all your most of your applications and all your data just come straight back. And you just have to install a few extra third-party apps again and maybe set up a few Bluetooth pairings. It's not that big a deal these days.
What I find interesting about all of this is sort of par for the course when you look at the Linux and Unix world, people rolling their own, adding and stuff, but it's not something that's really taken off in the mobile phone world.
I guess it has if you listen to the real geeks. If you hang around geek circles, they say, oh, yes, you can mod Android phones, you can mod Nokia phones, you can mod Samsung phones, and there's people who dedicate their lives to fiddling away in darkened rooms with this sort of thing. But I absolutely acknowledge this thing is a niche within a niche within a niche, and it's probably only 0.1% of, maybe 0.01% of owners actually even delve into this sort of thing. This is all particularly interesting only for the i910, because Samsung abandoned the firmware, thereby making it fair game. But so I do admit I'm being a bit geeky.
So there we are there, the HX firmware for Samsung. Obviously, support for Samsung is ongoing, although going forward, Samsung themselves, they've been talking about deciding which mobile phone operating system to use, and now they've put their chips down on both BATA and Android in a major way. So, Rafe, is this no more Symbian on Samsung, or is there something else lurking in the background that we're not quite sure of?
Well, this is from a news story that Reuters was reporting from IFA, which is the big consumer electronics show, which is going on in Germany right now. And they quoted a Samsung marketing spokesman as saying that, you know, there was a decision to focus on BATA and Android, which is something we've heard from them before. and that they saw Windows Mobile as only having sort of a relatively small specialist niche, and they would be producing one device. And they said they see no current demand for Symbian devices and currently have no plans to release a Symbian device. This doesn't come as an enormous surprise. They've said similar things in the past. But I think given the timing of this announcement, it does rule out any Symbian 3 device from Samsung. As Steve kind of suggested earlier, the sort of customer support that Samsung has been providing, particularly with regard to firmwares on the IFU 910, has been less than stellar. And so I don't actually think this will have much of an impact in terms of sales or anything like that. You know, Samsung total Symbian sales were probably in the few millions over its, you know, 8 or 9, 10 handsets that it's produced over the years. However, I'm sure it's going to be a blow to fans of the IFU 910, which, you know, especially given the timing of its announcement when it was available, you know, we're going back, you know, more than a year now. It was one of the most advanced phones on the market and still does pretty well in terms of the hardware specifications and its capabilities. You know, and Samsung just didn't really give it the support it needed, both from a customer support, but more critically from a marketing point of view. So yes, it does leave an interesting question over sort of Samsung and, you know, their platform choices. They've always been multi-OS, and I think that will continue. And they were, you know, clear to point out that, you know, if there is demand, they stand ready to produce Symbian handsets. However, given the kind of the pause we've had with Symbian 1, and to a certain extent going into Symbian 3, given there's a big UI change coming up with Symbian 4, the switch from Avcon to Qt, means it probably isn't the best time to be thinking about redoing Symbian handsets for the first time. And this applies to Samsung just as much as it does to sort of people looking to get in for the first time, you know, be that ZTE or Huawei. And so they may come back, you know, on Symbian 4 and Symbian 5. But I mean, if you consider the broader picture here, you know, Nokia still dominates the Symbian Foundation. Yes, it's theoretically a level playing field and there's open governments, but clearly with Nokia contributing the majority of the code, being the majority of the package owners and, you know, driving the development of the platform, Nokia is, you know, de facto in control. And as their biggest competitor, you know, Samsung is not going to want to be under that kind of control. That also, I think, will apply to Android in time, particularly as Samsung becomes more interested in doing service layer stuff. And so I think longer term, we'll see Samsung focusing as much of its efforts as possible on getting phones and devices, so that could include, you know, tablets and other things, running on their BARDA platform. And so it's quite interesting to see them, you know, talking up BARDA a lot. And I think in the next year, we'll see more and more things running BARDA. There's a sort of question in my mind is how big a role will Android play for them? I think in Samsung's ideal world, that everything would go BARDA, but I think the market demand and, you know, demand from their customers, particularly operators, may see, you know, Android handsets, you know, continue for a longer time, especially they're doing quite well. The Galaxy S just been announced that I think it sold a million devices in the US, and I believe it's also done a million units in Korea as well. So, you know, they're doing very well with the Android devices. But for the time being, at least, we will not expect to see any Samsung Symbian devices. And if I'm honest about it, I would probably be surprised to see them come back, possibly with Symbian 4 and Symbian 5. But it seems to me pretty clear that we're breaking down, in terms of mass market open mobile platforms, into kind of Android, BARDA, and Symbian. And this is looking forward a couple of years. And then there will be a number of, if you like, boutique platforms, which are equally open and can still ship in quite large numbers, like RIM, like iOS, Windows Phone 7, WebOS potentially, and of course the MeeGo devices, which will come from Nokia and other partners. You know, Intel is pushing that very strongly, obviously. So we're going to see that kind of shift. I should point out here that I'm talking mainly about handsets in that context, and there's clearly crossover between the two categories. You can't just divide it into kind of mass market open and boutique open. You know, clearly there is crossover between the two, and Android will operate in both spaces to an extent. Symbian has ambitions to do that, but I think Nokia is sort of having Symbian as its mass market, MeeGo is kind of the boutique. And as I say, you can never make predictions and be absolute about them, but that's roughly the pattern I see breaking down. And, you know, the big three players, if you like, are going to be Nokia, Samsung, and Google. And Google will effectively be collecting a lot of these smaller manufacturers, be it Sony Ericsson, Motorola, etc., HTC. And those will be the three big groupings, and outside of that, it'll be interesting to see what happens, because I think there'll be consolidation in platforms. We won't see all of those boutique ones necessarily survive. That said, they've now all got big backers with plenty of money, and it's, you know, critical for the future of mobile, obviously, but also technology in general, I'd say. So I don't think anyone will want to back out of this race anytime soon.
What I find interesting there is you bring up the issue of the service layer, and especially in Android, where you have to have that Gmail account to access all the services. To a certain extent, you know, Nokia have that lockout as well, because only they have access to the Ovi services, Ovi Apps and Music being the two sort of flagship and more obvious ones. So it's interesting that, you know, the thing that Nokia's been decried for is, oh, why are you playing around with Ovi? It's the same sort of thing that Samsung are now, you know, realizing what Google are doing to them and having to bring that into Bada. Do you think we're going to see Bada come up with this service layer as well that holds all the information in the cloud for your Samsung devices?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the US, they've already talked about the kind of the Samsung Media Hub, which is effectively an iTunes competitor. That's going to launch in the States first. But I'm sure they will be working on a sort of more generic service layer. And to an extent, they've already started doing it in the Bada platform. It's very service-centric in terms of the way it's put together and some of the APIs involved. It's interesting you bring up, you know, the Android Google question. I actually think, you know, mobile platforms before, it was about control of the platform, and that acted particularly as a break on Symbian because Nokia was seen as so dominant. But going forward, I think the service layer will become more important. And I've said before that Android is making the same mistakes that Symbian and Nokia made, and I think their mistake is, you know, and it's sort of part and parcel that Google has to do this. This is the way they make money. It's going to control the service layer on Android. Now, clearly, you can use Android without using some of the Google services. As you mentioned, you do kind of need the Google email address. But, you know, there are sort of splits coming off it, you know, particularly the Chinese port, which will be Android name only, sort of. But there is this kind of implicit service connection to the Google services with Android. And I think that will end up hurting them in the long run. If you think about Motorola and Sony Ericsson, they're already showing signs of wanting to put in their own bits of service layer, and that ends up being, I think, a little bit kludgy. And of course, the reason that HTC, Sony Ericsson, Motorola want to do that is they don't want to become effectively a Google OEM. Google will be quite happy if that happened, but the big handset manufacturers wouldn't like that. I mean, they want to avoid getting into the model we have in the PC market, where there's, you know, a couple of dominant platforms, and effectively there's very little to choose between the devices in one sense. Mobile is never going to be quite the same as that, because obviously they're more personal devices, design becomes more important, and I think there's still more expertise in the design of the various components, particularly around sort of radio systems. But even that's, you know, the hardware components, as we've seen, have become more and more commoditized in the last few years. So that, you know, that question of the Google service layer and what impact that has on Android going forward is very interesting. You get, Android has this honeymoon period now, but will that last as sort of the sort of differentiation in mobile devices moves more and more into the service layer? So it's, you know, one to ponder for the future.
And also in the whole service layer issue, we have Nokia following up with news that their Ovi Files service is to close down. This was their remote storage, similar idea to things like Dropbox. And that's closing down. And it's an interesting one because it seemed to be an important building block, you know, moving files around between computers and smartphones, offline and online access. Yet Nokia have now just stepped back and said, you know, there's some third parties that can do this. Is this a cooling of the Ovi strategy, or just a sort of retargeting and refocusing?
I mean, I agree with you. It's an interesting one, this, because I actually think Ovi Files was quite well put together and had a certain amount of utility, but it didn't really take off. And Nokia haven't been developing it particularly in terms of keeping up with the competition. You mentioned SugarSync and Dropbox there. But I think you're right when you suggest that this is kind of a rethinking of the strategy. I mean, back when Ovi launched at the Go Player event in London in 2007, I think it was, you know, it was very much the vision of Ovi of being a complete suite of services provided by Nokia. At the time, I think we said even then that it was a pretty ambitious goal, and that's proved to be the case. And I think now we've got to the point where Nokia is viewing Ovi more as a delivery service layer. So if you think about music, store, that's a delivery mechanism. If you think about OviStore, that's very obviously a content delivery mechanism. But even something like Maps, that's also turning into a content delivery mechanism. You know, the map is the basic platform layer, if you like, and all the services on top of it are the, you know, the content delivery. We're seeing it in the subtle services like, you know, TripAdvisor, Book-A-Table, Quipe, etc. But that's going to come on much more strongly in the future when we have this app on Maps platform running more obviously. At the moment, it's kind of not so obvious, but if you look at where Maps is going, it's going to become much more of a content delivery platform. And so I think Nokia, to a certain extent, it has retreated, but I think it might be better to term it focusing on its core services, and it can, you know, still make a lot of money by being that content delivery mechanism. There's clearly crossover here. You know, you can't just be content delivery mechanism. You have a certain amount of services, and Nokia's been interesting in that it's also providing a basic fallback for vital services. Good example of that is OviMail, but even that, to an extent, they're outsourcing by getting Yahoo to handle the back-end infrastructure, and they're just providing, if you like, the delivery mechanism for setting it up on the phone. And I think we'll see more of that. And certainly, you know, that was something that was talked about at Nokia World last year, becoming the ultimate kind of delivery mechanism as a service layer. And certainly in the last 12 months, Nokia have been a lot more proactive in approaching developers, service providers, content providers about getting their content. That's a lot of it's been around the OviStore, but it has had broader implications than that. I think, you know, a lot of people have criticized the OviStore and there's not a lot of content, and Nokia's being sort of hammered with the app gap, but they are working on that. But that thing, of course, does take quite a while to develop. And I think we'll see more evidence of this, particularly in 2011, as some of the partnerships with big companies come on stream. I think a good example of what's to come is the grocery application from Tesco's, but also some of the small deals we're seeing with things on top of OviMaps, TripAdvisor, I've already mentioned. So that kind of, it does represent a shift from what Ovi was originally, but if anything, it's a tightening of the strategy that Nokia are learning as they go along. In the meantime, they are closing down services, and I'm sad to see Ovi Files go, but if I'm honest, it's not really within the core scope of the Ovi strategy as it now stands. And so it does make sense, because clearly it would cost Nokia money to keep that running, and it does rather maybe dull the message of their core focus.
Yeah. The other issue here, of course, is that this is a wonderful place for third parties to step in and provide services that, you know, maybe 10 years ago you would have expected to come from the major companies. Uploading media to various social media websites is one of the big ones. David's been looking at Pixelpipe, David, which is, you know, I mean, we've got OviShare is there, but I suppose Pixelpipe is doing the same thing, but for lots of services.
Yes, that's right. Pixelpipe actually supports a staggering 110 services, and it's a broad range of services too. It's not just photo and video sharing sites, for social networks, for putting statuses up like Facebook and Twitter, blogging platforms like Blogger and WordPress, and even some really strange out of the ordinary things like FTP servers, Google Docs. And Pixelpipe have been on the go for a while, and for anyone who doesn't know about Pixelpipe, how the process went was that you would create an account on the Pixelpipe website and set up your pipes to whatever services you wanted to use on your phone. And then installing Pixelpipe was done either through a dedicated application or through downloading Share Online configuration files. But either way, the Nokia Share Online plugins were installed, and that's how it would work. You would use the Nokia Share Online user interface to upload files. And the Share Online user interface is okay, but it's not the most user-friendly of things. What Pixelpipe have done recently, this week, it was previewed by the Relay Mobile Project, just to give them props. They've created a new client called Send and Share, and they've streamlined the process of getting content out of your phone by creating a dedicated client, which totally bypasses the Share Online subsystem in your phone. How that streamlines things is that before using Share Online, you'd have to, say, take a photo, select Share, select Upload, then select Pixelpipe. Then you would get a list of all the pipes you've set up on the website. Now, Pixelpipe have actually got a menu option straight in the Send menu. So it's like Send, Pixelpipe, And then there's a whole new user interface, which is basically just three lines of text where you enter in a title, a description, and then you put in tags. And the tags control where the content goes. So you put in Twitter if you want to send a photo to Twitter or to Facebook, and so on. That latter part is something I'm not sure about is whether it's a good idea, because in the old Share Online system, you could actually visually select from the list, which would be helpful if you do have a lot of pipes and you are with slightly different names. But now you're having to do it, you're just having to type in individual words. So that's okay if you're only using a few services with obvious names, but I'm not sure if it will scale well for people who have got an insane amount of services.
And I wonder just how many people have that insane amount of services. I mean, it's just like, you know, there's so many photo sharing sites, but I just tend to just Flickr, for example.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would be a minority case. But it's just I do tend to associate typing things in rather than visually selecting things with power users. I think if normal users can't select something on a screen, it might make them think twice about what they're doing. Another nice feature that they've added in to the new send and share is actually being able to share map locations on Ovi Maps. And it doesn't even have to be your current location. You can select any location on the map and select send Pixelpipe and just upload it. And it will appear, it's a limited use case that they're doing it with at the moment, because you can only create geotagged tweets. You can't do anything else. And there's no way to get pull those geotagged tweets into, back into Ovi Maps if you see someone's tweet. So it's nice to see it there, but it is limited usability. And the other criticism I had of the new send and share client is that while Pixelpipe's website supports three types of authentication, native accounts, Twitter, or Ovi, you can only either log in with or create a new native account on the new client. So if you had all your pipes set up under a Twitter account like I did when I started to review this, you have to start from scratch, which is a minor annoyance, but it does just slow you down getting going with things.
I think Pixelpipe's a great service, and I think David's absolutely right when he's saying it's for advanced users. It reminds me what I was saying about the Ovi service layer, in that Noki provide the base layer, that's Ovi Share and sort of Share Online, and yet they're leaving it to someone else to do the more advanced stuff. And I think that sort of providing of a basic layer makes sense, you know, particularly for people who don't have existing accounts. But most of us do have existing accounts and want to use those. And so being able to have something that gets your photos onto Facebook, Flickr, or some of the, you know, smaller services that Pixelpipe supports makes a lot of sense. But that kind of strategy of having a basic support level is something, you know, Nokia are doing quite a lot. They're doing it in email, they're doing it in instant messaging, but they are assuming that users generally will also have existing things. You know, in email, they let you set up any existing account you like and will make it a push or consumer push account for you. Likewise, with the sort of IM services, they do have Ovi Chat, but they're really now pushing more into Microsoft Messenger, Yahoo Messenger, AOL, etc. I think this same story can be seen here in sharing media and where you upload your media to. You know, Share Online provides basic support and supports the really big services like Flickr. It'll be interesting to see whether they extend the number of services they support there, but they provide Share as the base level, and then they're leaving their partners to do the next thing up. And actually, I think that's, you know, quite a sensible move, because it's going to be impossible for them to provide everything, as we suggested earlier. So it's that focus again on being the delivery platform, albeit with providing a base level so that people, particularly in the emerging markets, do have an option to set something up straight from the phone, have a guaranteed basic level, but more advanced users can use the stuff they want to.
It's also an interesting approach from Nokia. They start with the basic stuff and then they hand it out. And it's the same thing as we said earlier that they're doing with Maps. Maps is the base level. Content gets put on top of that, pushed through, and Nokia continue to iterate the changes on that as well. Steve, are doing the latest iteration of Ovi Maps, which I understand you've been looking at this week.
Yes, Nokia seem to have pushed out an update for the technically minded 3.4. Version 10, week 32, build 3, but don't get too hung up on that. Basically, pushed out, just as far as I can see, every single S63rd edition and 5th edition handset. And the main change, it seems to be under the hood. You may remember that in a previous version, about 2 or 3 months ago, they introduced their version of Wi-Fi positioning, whereby it scans for the local Wi-Fi IDs of routers around you. It doesn't actually try and log in or anything. Just scans for the IDs. And then for building up its own database on a Nokia servers, it then looks that up, say, which SSIDs are around you, and then gives back an approximate position. Now, when I first tried it and they first introduced it, obviously their databases were very, very sparse, and it gave me a position about 3 miles away. I noticed with this new version, things have been tightened up, obviously, on the back end and also in the client. And now, booting up the new version, even in the middle of a house on a device I hadn't turned on for weeks, I got a fix that was about 20 yards out, just on Wi-Fi positioning. So it does look like Nokia have now got in the same ballpark as Skyhook and Google and the other companies that have big Wi-Fi databases. So that was the main change I noticed. Of course, a lot of that is on the back end as well. It is a full 8 to 10 megabyte update, depending on the device you've got. People have asked whether, by installing this 10 megabyte update, whether you then lose another 10 megabyte in your C disk. In theory, it should overwrite the appropriate files from the previous version, assuming that wasn't in the firmware. So you don't need to worry too much. If you are worried, I would just say go into the application manager on your phone and remove the previous version of your maps and then apply the update. That way you're absolutely sure to minimize the impact on your C disk. I still suspect people with an N97 Classics might struggle to apply this update. So if your Maps is working on N97, probably best to leave well alone. But for others, it's recommended. I'm sure there are bug fixes as well under the hood. So go download, really.
And as always, before you do any sort of major change to your phone or any experimentation, back it up first. It's old, it's hackneyed, but it can still prove very, very useful. Other things where people have been asking about, does it take up the extra memory and destroy the C drive, is the beta release of Swipe from the Nokia Beta Labs. This is a new keyboard interface for getting your text to your device. It's been available on other platforms for some time now. Essentially, it's a keyboard, but rather than lift your finger, you just slide it along and it works out where, when you stop over a key, it thinks, oh, you're trying to press the key there. That mixed with a sort of T9-esque having a look at what words and letters could be to guess the correct word. I've popped this on the X6, and I have to say, even though I really love T9, especially on the X6 search screen, which is strange in itself, Swipe is proving to be almost as fast, if not slightly faster, when doing general texting, replying to tweets and such. Like, I'm really enjoying this interface. And I know that some of you guys have been looking at it as well there. And Rafe, you're still sort of half and half about whether Swipe's a good replacement or not.
Yeah, I mean, that's a personal view in that I've sort of been using it a little bit, and I have used it on other platforms, and I do rather like it. I would say it works best on a capacitor screen like the X6. It's slightly Agreed. More fiddly on a resistive screen. That said, if you're using it on a resistive screen, use a stylus and you should have no problems whatsoever. And I think particularly on the capacitor screen, where there's slightly less accuracy than the resistor screens, it makes the Mini QWERTY, particularly in portrait mode, perfectly usable. In landscape mode, I think honestly there's less to choose between the two. The good thing in portrait mode is you can choose to go back to alphanumeric entry or Mini QWERTY, and so I think the way it's been integrated has been done very nicely, and so you do get the choice. And after all, this is what it comes down to for me, why it's a good thing. You know, it is about choice. And I felt for a while that, you know, Symbian and S65th edition in particular has been a bit behind the competition in the sort of on-screen keyboard entry of text, sort of inputting text. And most of the time it's not a problem because people don't generally write great, you know, lots of text on their mobile phone. But it has been a bit of an issue. And so I think Swipe goes a long way to addressing this. And so, you know, it's very good to see this kind of choice come onto the platform. But I would say it's not for everybody. And there is a bit of a learning curve. But at the moment, it's available free on Nokia Beta Labs. And I would imagine it's going to remain that way. It may well be integrated into some Nokia devices, or it may end up on Obvi Store at a small cost. But it's certainly worth trying if you want to have an alternative input mechanism. And at the end of the day, choice is going to be a good thing.
Yeah, it's also worth pointing out for those of you with the Nokia X6 is running firmware 21.0.0.0.4 and above, you no longer have the Mini Portrait QWERTY keyboard for Swipe to replace, so you will have to be using it in landscape mode. According to the Beta Labs website, they're having a look to see if they can find out a way to fix this. Beta software, as always, you take your chances and sometimes it disappears. You know, as we saw with social messaging closing down, sometimes they just get rolled up and the knowledge is spread out among amongst the red of the rest of the firmware. So just to be aware that you will have some issues if you decide to pick up on Swipe. Okay, HD voice. HD voice! If you had a really advanced MP3 player, you would have spotted the howl around effect there. If you're on your phone, tough. It sounded exactly the same. This is now coming to the Orange Network in the UK, available on certain of the Nokia handsets. David, is this just some great big marketing gimmick, like getting us to spend another £3 to get 3D sound at the cinema?
No, there is some benefit to it. I'll cover the consumer side of it first, and then I'll get under the hood with the science part. Orange are doing this, it seems to be almost straight away, and it's going to be on a very limited set of phones. We've got the Nokia 5230 X6 E5 and Samsung's Omnia Pro. Although these are only going to be on handsets that people buy moving forwards from now. They're not going to, according to the research I've done, they're not going to be sending firmware patches back to phones that people have already bought. And obviously, for now, it's only going to be orange-to-orange calls. So there's not a lot of people going to be enjoying this. And also, it's debatable whether support is going to be brought into landline networks for this as well. I mean, especially when you consider the variability of copper cabling in the last 100 metres to each building. I have listened to a test call, and there is a notable difference, although Orange claim it's crystal clear voice quality. It isn't.
Hold on, Steve, do you remember what crystal radios used to sound like?
Oh, that was before my time, Ewan.
So, yes, it is crystal clear. You know, you mean you never made a crystal radio at school?
No, I was surprised.
Oh, I see you are. So, crystal clear quality. Really a good marketing idea. But carry on, David.
Thank you. It is an improvement. Now, here's why. So here's the science part, everybody. The codec that we've been using so far is called AMR, which is short for Adaptive Multi-Way Codec. And it's now been upgraded to Adaptive Multi-Way Wideband. Both codecs are similar in that they have 8 bit rate levels, which... And here's the adaptive part, because you get high bit rate for more complicated audio signals. Although the new AMR WB standard has got higher bit rates, but the real difference is, and it's actually quite simple when you get down to it, it's sampling audio from a greater range of frequencies. And for anyone who wants numbers, AMR WB is doing 50 to 7,000 hertz, whereas the old AMR codec that we're all still using only does 300 to 3,400. So that's it, really. That's where the quality comes in, but don't expect to be using it soon.
Okay, everybody else, you can wake up now. Thank you, David. So, in a serious point, though, David, are we expecting this to expand out through other networks? What to our time scale? Months, years? What are the sort of limiting factors to get this into everybody's handsets?
Well, I haven't heard any hints that any other networks are bringing this in. Probably the first network to get it after Orange will be T-Mobile when they bring their networks together. But what the timescale is on that, I don't know. But I'm sure other networks will follow. But there's no timescale yet. And we even need to have more compatible handsets as well. So it is going to be a long time until anyone can actually enjoy this.
Yeah, as David says, it's absolutely... it does improve the quality, but perhaps not as much as the marketing claims. There are various operators around the world who have said they're going to do HD voice. Orange has already launched it in Romania and says that it's making people more loyal to their network. However, that's Orange saying that, so I'm not sure how much we can read into it. I think we may see this come in more with some of the LTE networks where it would make sense to do this kind of upgrade at that point in time. But, I mean, as David says, there's a network effect at work here because you need both the network to support it and the device itself. And so I think in terms of expecting voice quality something jump overnight, that's not going to happen. It's going to be many years, just as it was with SMS and MMS, before you get the kind of levels where it's been introduced such that you can expect it to be a common occurrence.
Right then. I actually remember when Orange was £5 for all the SMSs you could send for the entire month. Oh, happy days indeed. Right then. And now, who feels like having a first on the podcast?
Absolutely.
Okay. Steve's going to do an unboxing.
Well, I thought I could do an absolute first. You've heard of photo unboxings and video unboxings with or without an Emu. I thought I'd do an audio unboxing. So have a listen to this. This is the new Nokia E5.
You can feel the cardboard there. God, so exciting.
Did you enjoy that? More seriously, I have in my hand the Nokia E5, hot off the Nokia's presses. Woohoo! I have some, my first impressions are it's astonishingly solid. It reminds me very much of the old Nokia E71. It's got the double clips at the back that hold the battery cover on. So unlike the E72, you haven't got the back cover wobbling up and down and back side to side. Really, really solid plastic. Lovely stainless steel battery cover as well. The keyboard's lovely, controls are lovely, but then we come to the big caveat so far. You'll probably have read my text review on All About Symbian by the time you listen to this podcast, but just in case you haven't, the E5 is very much designed down to a cost. Despite the build quality being lovely, the screen is fairly low cost and it's transmissive TFT, not transflective like every other Nokia non-touch phone just about since time began, which means that you go outside in sunlight and you can't see the screen. Whether this is a problem for people remains to be seen. I guess at the lower end of the market, they'll buy it on price and just accept that's a compromise. If you're a hardened All About Symbian reader, then you're going to want to save your money and get the E72 or whatever follows the E72 as well. It's got an EDOF camera on the back, which is the extended depth of field, which means it's excellent for taking quick and dirty snaps and basically gets most things in for most people, but you can't do anything really arty. You can't get close to things and don't expect Carl Zeiss quality and really good handling of colours and light either. One other comment on price, just this, I only had this E5 for a couple of hours now, but on Nokia's online shop, it's down at £259, which seems way overpriced, but could be considering that on the same Nokia shop, the E72, which admittedly has been out for a while now, is £269 with a much higher specification. RAM aside. But if you look online, I see that the E5, likes of play.com and many other online retailers, is already below 200, which makes an awful lot more sense. So for something that will probably end up at about £169, £179, it's a good budget alternative to the E72 and it's a worthy success to the E63, but just don't buy it if you're heading out in the sun a lot. Ray, if you had a comment.
Yeah, no, I agree with you with what you said. And the screen is disappointing, but I guess this is what Nokia is going to do some product differentiation at lower prices. They've done exactly the same thing with the Nokia C5, incidentally, got that sort of transmissive screen technology. For some people, you know, that's a deal breaker. For others, it's not. But I think the thing to celebrate about the E5 is that you've got this fantastic build quality at this low price, and that's kind of what stands out for me. They've been able to maintain the build quality of kind of the E-series devices, particularly the E71. The E72, I never had the same problems with the battery cover just because mine fitted in, but I know a lot of people did. But getting that kind of level of build quality and that real solidity that feels like, I mean, I've seen one of the prototypes, and it really feels like you could hammer something into the wall with this device at that kind of low price is, I think, pretty unprecedented, particularly in this QWERTY range. And as Steve says, this is going to be the 150, 160 price point, replacing the E63. So it's a very solid handset indeed. It's probably not going to excite that many people because of the pricing. It's not touchscreen. It's not sexy. But actually, I think Nokia, screen aside, onto a bit of a winner with this one.
So there we go then, the E5, just one of the many things that we're seeing from Nokia. And of course, coming up soon, we have Nokia World, which we will talk about next week, because we have a big preview show lined up for that, sort of looking at the sort of landscape as it is, where we're expecting it to change. We'll also be coming to you live from Nokia World as well during the event, so stay listening to allaboutsymbian.com for that, as much as you can listen to our website, but you all know what I mean. I've still got 1970s DJ hat on. But before we do that, I just want to ask each of you very briefly, what's the one thing that you're not expecting to see, you don't want to see at Nokia World in the middle of September? Steve?
I'm not expecting to see a Scion Series 8. Although, we have seen a lot of leaked protos and models on the net, which may or may not be true, but you have to admit some of them do look a bit like an old Scion 5MX Palm Top, which is still a beloved form factor by many, many people. I don't expect to see a Scion Series 8, but wouldn't it be cool if there was something that was pretty similar?
You realise it's been so long that I haven't got the loose change to jangle to get you to put it into the Scion swear box now.
I get off free.
yeah. Rafe?
Despite everyone else's expectations, I'm not expecting to see a Nokia Android device. And we've said on the podcast there's very good reasons for that. But if I see one more suggestion that that's what Nokia will be doing at Nokia World, I think I'll scream. I'm also hoping that I won't be seeing me holding my hands around Ewan's neck as I'm trying to control him from doing something at Nokia World. But you never know.
Can I just say, Nokia, if any of the product managers are listening and you'd like to fake up a Nokia Android just to show Rafe in a private 101 briefing, we will make sure we have cameras ready. David?
On a humorous note, I'm hoping I don't see any more phones with interchangeable covers. And I am not expecting to see any honestly, I'm not expecting to see any Mego devices, but it'd be nice if there was.
And for me personally, I'm not expecting to see good, solid coverage in the mainstream media at the same sort of level that you'd get at a Google or an Android or an Apple developer conference as well. Even though the numbers match up, I think we'll be lucky to get 30 seconds on Dot Rory's blog on the BBC, and that will be about it.
That's because they're holding it at XL in the hinterlands of the Docklands.
It's right next to an airport.
Yeah, but it's at least half an hour away from all the central drinking bars in London, so you know, I'm not sure people even know where it is, do they?
Oh, that's true. The BBC are moving all the web stuff up to Salford anyway, so next year we'll have to have Nokia Manchester. Won't that be fun? Right then, but for now, fun has been the All About Insight Symbian podcast. Rearrange that into make a sentence for you. Editing's wonderful. It was number 134. We had David Gilson.
Thank you, everybody.
We had Steve Litchfield.
Thank you very much. And my voice is gradually holding out, I'm glad to say.
That's fine. If ever you need a Hawkwind tribute band, I'll just have Steve talk for another hour and you should have the voice down. Perfect. We have Rafe.
Goodbye, everybody.
Who just gets just a first name because he's not paid me this month yet. And we have myself hosting the show for this time, Ewan Spence. We'll be doing Nokia World Preview next week and then live from the event. If you're going to be around at the event and you want to be on the show, get quick interviews, promote your software, or just want to say hi to us because you're a blogger who's left and come back and done the hokey-cokey with your support of Symbian, we would love to have you back on the show. But for now, www.allaboutsymbian.com for all your postings, your news, your comments, and your thoughts. Thank you very much for listening. We'll catch you in the next show. Ta-ra!